or visit will.illinois.edu/Illinois Radio Reader for more information. The Illinois Radio Reader is a service of Illinois Public Media.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Michelle Martin is away. It's been a year since a bombing near the finish line of the Boston Marathon killed three people and injured hundreds of others. The tragedy brought a massive outpouring of grief and concern from all over the world. People sent flowers, running shoes, messages, quilts, and all kinds of things to Boston. We wanted to look at how these public expressions have helped individuals and their communities outside of Massachusetts to cope with the tragedy. And here to talk about that is Rich Harwood. He's the founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. That's a nonprofit group that facilitates community discussions, and he's worked closely in helping Newtown, Connecticut come together and move forward after the shooting in Sandy Hook. Also joining us, Danny Bent. He's a Brit who set up One Run for Boston. That's a nonstop running relay from L.A. to Boston that ended in Boston on Sunday. More than 2,000 runners took part. And finally, Mary Thomas is with us as well. She's a knitter from Hollis, New Hampshire, who's knitted 20 scarves for the Boston Marathon Scarf Project that was set up by the Old South Church, which is known to runners as the Church of the Finish Line in Boston. And that group has collected, I guess, nearly 7,000 scarves from across the world to give to Boston Marathon runners and survivors. Welcome to all of you.
Good to be with you.
So, Mary, were you present for the bombing? Did you have family members present?
I was actually at Fenway Park for the Red Sox game and was at lunch 1 mile from the finish line when it happened.
But other than that, that's your only connection is physical proximity, right?
Physical proximity, and in a small town, you learn to, that you know someone who knows someone who was involved.
What was it about the process of making a scarf that did something for you, and what did it do for you?
I've been involved with other projects, such as prayer shawls, and the thought of these scarves as a symbol of comfort and strength means the same thing to me as prayer shawls have been for the sick in our parish. And so it's that similar message of strength and love.
And then let me go to you, Danny Bent. Many of the runners that participate in your relay didn't have a personal connection with the Boston bombing, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, we had them from all over the country. Some of them didn't know anyone had taken part. And obviously, there's us guys, the organizers. We were in the UK, and we didn't know. I knew one person in the whole of the United States.
So all the way across the pond, as we say, you felt like you had to do something. I mean, I have to assume it's grief, right?
I guess it is grief, and I mean, part of it is anger, and you have some forms of guilt, I think, as well as a runner, that those people were there and you weren't. It seems strange to say it, the guilt that you weren't there at the time.
And so setting up an event that's largely symbolic accomplishes what for you? What kind of comfort does that bring you?
I just think, I mean, for myself and for all the runners that took part, we all felt this kind of pain that everyone here in Boston was feeling. And everyone wanted to do something. We didn't want to just kind of open up our wallets and just hand over some notes. We wanted to kind of stand up and kind of show our strength and solidarity for the people of Boston, and especially for those people who had been affected.
Rich, what we're hearing are stories from people who have done something that almost has more symbolic power than tangible power, right?
Well, I think, you know, in so much of our lives these days, we are divided against one another, pitted against one another. And I think the bombing was an affront to our sense of community, our sense of fairness. And I think what we see is a sense of people wanting to belong, to be part of something larger than themselves, to express, as Mary said, both a sense of comfort and also, I think, equally important, a sense of strength, a sense of resilience that, while this has set us back, it won't do us in.
How real is this emotional grief and trauma that somebody might experience from perhaps thousands of miles away?
I think it's real. I think, you know, in my involvement in Newtown, people would come up to me in airports, at meetings, in other places, and grab my hand and want to hold my hand and talk about what happened in the community, about how people were making their way forward, about how people were dealing with the challenges in their daily lives. I think it's, again, a sense of a shared experience that in so many ways we don't have in our society now, that I think piques people's interest and calls them forward and makes them want to both be with other people in a way and help folks move forward. And in doing that, I think we are helping ourselves move forward in an important way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about public expressions of grief and support after an event like the Boston Marathon bombing and how it can help people around the world deal with a tragic event like that. Mary Thomas, you've said that there have been scarves sent to the Boston Scarf Project from as far away as Russia, India, Australia. Many of these people have never been to Boston, maybe will never be to Boston. What do you think they get out of both making these scarves and then sending them?
I think they get that sense of connection. And as the senior minister of Old South Church, Nancy Taylor, has said, it's as if we're knitting the world back together with love and courage.
And Danny Bent, again, let me go back to some of your participants. What do you hear from them when they finish their role in the relay? What's their response, the feeling that they get?
Well, it's funny what Mary said about knitting. We've knitted this community that have... You know, we're passing on a baton from one person to the other, and it feels like we've put our arms around the United States. And the runners are kind of saying that, you know, they have taken this positivity from it, really, is the big factor, and the camaraderie and the kind of family that's come from this. We call it a family, basically. This was the biggest surprise when we did this, is that everyone has stood by each other, not just during this crisis with the Boston Marathon and getting over the Boston Marathon, but there's this community that's supporting each other through daily life as well.
How is that different than, say, responding to somebody over social media, tweeting back to someone, having a conversation over Facebook about this?
That's hard to answer. I think the fact that there is this physicality and people have been watching, the baton's got a tracker on it, they've been watching it across the country, and it's actually physical. And at every interchange, they're putting their arms around each other and they're holding each other close and saying, thank you for bringing the baton to me. And then at exactly the same point, 10 miles on, they get the same response from the next runner.
Rich, so you deal with people who are dealing with grief most of the time, I assume, on a personal level, where a family member has been injured or dealt with it, or they themselves have somehow been affected, right?
Right. And I think what we're hearing from Danny and Mary is that there is the personal grieving that takes place, the individual grieving, but there is also a collective grieving. There's something about us reconstituting our community, our sense of community. I think you have to remember that underlying all this, at least in the United States, is a deep yearning among Americans to come back into community life, to find a way to reconnect and reengage with one another, and to do it around something that we share in common, something that is collective, something that grows out of something that we aspire to achieve together. And I think the response to the Boston bombing is one signal or one sign of that deep yearning and people trying to make it real in their individual lives, but I think as importantly in our collective lives.
So, Mary, you say that you have done this kind of thing for other tragic events as well?
Just our group does chemo camps for cancer survivors and prayer shawls for those who are sick or have had losses.
Help me understand, Mary, the evolution for you of grief and I guess shock and surprise that you must have felt on the day of the Boston bombings and where you are a year later and how that was affected or what role did the knitting project have to play in guiding this evolution?
The shock of living in a small community like Hollis and having such a tragedy where so many were injured, where all those runners are there for a peaceful expression of athleticism. And, you know, we're sheltered in a small town, but not unaffected. When a tragedy like this happens, the community comes together and really strengthens. And I think that the scarves are a tangible way of us giving something to show support and courage and really hope for these runners that they stay strong and run well.
So, Rich, does it matter what a community chooses to do or what an individual chooses to do? And I mean, if you're feeling grief about something that's happened, you know, I felt a lot of grief over about what happened in Haiti or say the typhoon. whatever I choose to do to deal with that grief or express grief publicly, does it matter what it is?
Well, I think in a community, there are all signs of public expressions of grief. I think it probably matters less that they're, you know, uniform in their expressions as much as the sentiments are felt and the sense of you're not alone, that there are other people there, that you have a sense of support, that we understand that this is a long-term healing process, that this isn't just simply a flash in the pan. I think those sentiments become very important in terms of a community being able to pull together and move forward.
And Danny, what is the benefit of the public portion of that grief, that public expression? What difference does it make when you express that grief in a physical, tangible way that other people can see, and the expressing it at home among your family and your friends?
I think if you can express it publicly, I mean, it makes people feel as though they're not alone. I mean, we were sitting there in the UK and we're feeling this pain and you're not really sure who to talk to, or when you do it publicly, it brings forth, people who are feeling that similar emotion, and connections are made, and I think that can help quite a lot.
Danny Bent is an organizer of One Run for Boston. That's a relay run from L.A. to Boston. He's also author of the book Not All Superheroes Wear Capes, which is about the race. Also, Rich Harwood, founder and president of the Harwood Institute for Public Innovation. That's a nonprofit group that facilitates community discussion. Also author of a number of books, including The Work of Hope, How Individuals and Organizations Can Authentically Do Good. And Mary Thomas, a knitter from Hollis, New Hampshire, who became involved with the Boston Marathon Scarf Project with Old South Church. Thanks to all three of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Just ahead, it's National Poetry Month, and we want everyone to tweet us their poems, whether they be poets or political watchers.
As a kid who grew up in hip-hop, I dreamed of one day being a rapper, and I never had the skills. So to even put 140 characters into some poetic sense was quite challenging.
Twitter Poetry brings out the artist in the Global Grind's Michael Skolnick. That's coming up on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Bob Culkeen, station manager at Illinois Public Media. We recently wrapped up our spring radio membership campaign. Thank you to each donor who supported us. Though we came up short of our goal, we still raised nearly $100,000 from over 500 supporters. On behalf of all our listeners, thanks for your investment in high-quality public radio. If you didn't have a chance to make a pledge, it's never too late to call 217-244-9455 or go to willpledge.org. Thanks.
Programming on WILL is made possible by McKinley Presbyterian Church, a progressive faith community of welcome, reconciliation, and hope. You can experience McKinley's Easter Week activities and services beginning Sunday, April 13th, 5th and John Streets, Champaign. Details at www.mckinley-church.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. For those of you procrastinators, today at midnight is the deadline to file your taxes. But if you've been putting it off, you may not have to rush around to get it done tonight. You could file for an extension. Here to give us insight on how the whole thing works is Kevin McCormally of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. Welcome back.
Thank you.
So you have by midnight tonight not only to file your taxes, but also to file for an extension, correct?
And if you want to know the big secret, 75% of taxpayers don't have to do anything by midnight tonight, because the penalty for failing to file for that extension is a percent of the amount of money you owe on your tax return. And since 75% of us get big refunds, there's no penalty for being late. Now, there are a few people who make arcane elections on the return that have to file for the extension. But for most of us, it doesn't matter. But let's talk about how to do the extension.
That's right. Because if you, I mean, you have to be very certain you don't owe anything. Because if you don't pay, you're supposed to pay by tonight, even if you don't file, correct?
That's right. And that's the reason. If you owe money, you have to file for that extension. So if you want to get it done and make the IRS happy and file that extension, it's really easy to do. You don't even have to go to the post office anymore. You can do it online. IRS.gov has a thing they call free file, and anybody can use it, free fillable forms. I just did it right before I came over. I fired up my computer and I filed for an extension for my mother, whose return I do. It took me 5 minutes. Her name and address, how much money we think she owes for 2013, how much money she paid through withholding on her IRA distributions, how much we owe to hit the return, you're done. You can either print it out and send a check to the IRS, or you can actually pay online with a credit card, a debit card, or with direct electronic payment from your checking account. So it's really easy.
What are the justifiable reasons for filing an extension? Do you have to have a good reason?
None whatsoever. Any reason at all. You just ask for it, they have to give it to you, as long as you pay with the extension request. Now, if the estimate of how much you owe is unreasonable, the IRS can deny the request ex post facto and charge you with the penalties for failure to file. I had a friend yesterday said, well, what's reasonable? And I said, well, you know, if you owe $1,000 and you pay them $500, that's reasonable. If you owe $10,000 and you pay them $500, they probably would decide that's unreasonable. It's a facts and circumstances issue. It's up to you. You know, you need to try to estimate. But if you come within 90% of what you actually owe, no penalty.
And okay, so let's say I file an extension. How long do I have then to file my tax?
That buys you 6 months until October 15th. Get it done by then, and you're fine.
I want to be clear, though. Let's say that I owe money, and I pay a reasonable amount. I still have 6 months
sure.
to file, or I'm supposed to be paying on my debt?
No. Celeste, you put that in. You send in your reasonable estimate of what you owe, and you've got 6 months to file. The key thing is to file something by midnight tonight if you owe money, because there are two penalties the IRS can assess. A failure to pay penalty if you don't pay enough, that's one half of what you owe, one half of a percent per month. The failure to file is 10 times as much as that. It's 5% a month. So if you owe $1,000 and don't file at all, it's $50 a month penalty. If you file, even if you don't pay a nickel, it's $5 a month penalty. So that's the reason you want to file that extension, even if you can't pay. And we say that same thing to people who've done their returns, but they get it all done and they say, my God, I haven't got $750 to send the government. Send your return in anyway, even if you can't pay a penny. Pay what you can. But even if you can't pay anything, send it in. The IRS will send you a bill, but it will protect you from the failure to file penalty. And that's the big one.
Most people don't owe any money, though, right? Most people are owed a refund from the government.
Right.
At that point, do you get a failure to file penalty?
No, the government, believe it or not, doesn't care if it owes you money. In fact, as of midnight,
I believe
tonight,
that actually.
You know, the IRS puts out a press release in mid-March every year saying how much money taxpayers are about to lose because they never filed their return 3 years ago. And right now, we're talking about the 2010 returns. The right to ask for a refund that you should have asked for with the 2010 return expires at midnight tonight, and the IRS has over $750 million of refunds that it knows it owes people because it got withholding and nobody asked for it back because they never filed a return. Maybe they didn't think they had to file. I think a lot of them are scared to file because they get to be late and they don't realize if they have money coming back, there's no penalty. But as of midnight tonight, those 2010 returns, $750 million just goes into the government's coffers, not back to the taxpayers.
It's kind of like finding a wallet and just keeping it.
It sort of is, except they really do go out of their way trying to. A lot of press releases, they break it down by state, how many people in New Jersey have money owed to them, how many people in Iowa, how many people in Tennessee. It comes down, they put it out. The media talks about this a lot, but mainly we're talking probably about people who have refunds coming because of the earned income tax credit, people who don't understand the tax law, and people who really want to be underground, and they don't understand that their employer was withholding taxes. They didn't really owe anything. They should get that money back.
We have been hearing news about people who didn't get a tax refund, although they were expecting it because for one reason or another, the government grabbed that money. What are the circumstances under which the government can keep your tax refund?
Okay, well, there are several of them. The big thing in the news lately, the scandal, a great story by the Washington Post discovered that a bill signed into law in 2008 lifted the 10-year statute of limitations for how long the government can go after debts from taxpayers by grabbing their tax refund. And so some people at the Social Security Administration, and nobody knows who it was, decided to start going after some really old debts. And in fact, they were going after children for debts of their parents, where their parents were overpaid Social Security benefits. Well, the case in the Post, the most egregious example, was a 50-year-old debt, and they went after the daughter for it, and they took her tax refund. But as of yesterday, Social Security said, oh, gee, we don't mean to do that. Yeah, there's a lot of hell raised on Capitol Hill, and they stopped it. But if you owe child support, they can take your refund and give it to your ex-spouse. If you have debts on student loans, they can grab your refund and pay off that debt. And coming next year, Celeste, this is going to be a big issue, because the only way the IRS has to enforce the Obamacare penalty for people who don't buy insurance is to take their tax refund. This is going to be a huge issue next year. Social Security is safe for now. Everybody who doesn't get insurance is going to be in trouble next year.
One last quick question. Is it true that if you file late, you're more likely to get audited?
I don't believe it is true. There are some people who say you shouldn't file an extension. Some people say you should file an extension because then they have less time to audit your return. But they're not going to audit this year's returns for a year and a half. So whenever they get in there, if the computer smells something bad about your return, they're going to send you a letter.
Kevin McCormally is editorial director of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine. He joined us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now it's time for Muses and Metaphor. That's our ode to National Poetry Month. All through April, we're featuring original tweet-length poems. That's 140 characters or less, delivered by Twitter and written by NPR listeners mostly, but also new this year, some of our regular contributors. On Friday, we hosted a Twitter chat about the series with writer and hip-hop artist MK Asante and Chicago poet Malcolm London. You can see that conversation if you missed it by searching the hashtag TMMPoetry. But today, Laura Martinez and Michael Skolnick join us to share their Twitter poems. They are regular contributors to The Beauty Shop and Barbershop. Welcome back, both of you.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So both of you already tweet pretty regularly and write regularly, usually about news and pop culture, though. So, Laura, was it harder to write a poem?
Totally hard. I mean, I'm not a poetry writer at all. But what I loved about this experience was the possibility to play with a bilingual poem, which is pretty much what would define all my tweets.
Right, and we're gonna hear your poem in just a moment. But Michael, what about you? Harder to write about the news and politics or the poem?
Well, as a kid who grew up in hip hop, I dreamed of one day being a rapper, and I never had the skills to write poetry as well as some of the greats. So to even put 140 characters into some poetic sense was quite challenging.
Well, let's hear the poems. Laura, can you share your poem?
Mine?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. Me quiere, no me quiere. He loves me, he loves me not. Pondering this and other things over a margarita, the flower, not the drink.
So let's talk a little bit about that poem. Did you have to edit it down to 140 characters? Did you have way more than that?
No, not at all. Not at all. And what I liked about it, it's that when people in this country, I am from Mexico, when people hear the word margarita, they would think of a drink. And as some of you might know, a margarita is a daisy. And it's a flower that you use to, pluck the petals and wonder if you've been loved or not.
All right. So, Michael, let's hear your poem.
Sure. Martin Richard, 8 years on earth. No more hurting people. Peace. Rest in peace. Boston, stay strong. Love, New York.
And why choose this subject? That's a heavy subject for 140 characters.
Well, a year ago today marks the anniversary of the Boston bombing, and it was a traumatic experience for folks in Boston, of course, but everyone across this country. I stayed up almost for 48 hours covering that story. My son was quite young at the time. He's now 1 year old. And I was reflecting this morning on the young boy Martin Richard, who lost his life and held that sign, that sort of image that we saw after his death of when saying, "No more hurting people, peace." Such a powerful sign of a young man who lost his life way too soon. And as a New Yorker, and we often, you know, like to antagonize our friends in Boston, and they antagonize us over sports and things of superficial like that. But on a day like today, wanted to make sure that they knew that we're thinking of them and that we love them and that we hope they get through the day.
I wonder for both of you, one of the big limitations here is the brevity, right? So, Laura, what's the benefit of writing this short a poem, do you think?
I mean, I think is that you have to be super creative. And I love to play with language, as I said. And, for example, I go on the net collecting very brief sentences that attract me because there's so much you can do with language. The shorter the space, the more challenging, but the more beautiful things you can say.
And Michael, what do you think? Is there a benefit to writing this short a message?
I think some of the greatest poets are those who write haikus, right? And those are very challenging to write. That's what's great about short form, even what's great about Twitter, is that I look at Twitter as an art, not just as a place to share what I'm eating or what I'm doing or where I'm going on the weekend, but as an art to perfect 140 characters. I might spend an hour on one tweet just looking at it and trying to perfect every single word within that 140 characters. And that, to me, is really enjoyable because it's a challenge.
So what advice, Laura, would you give to a listener getting ready to write their own Twitter poem?
Just write from your heart. Write from your heart. Really, I cannot say anything else. I struggled a lot because usually I am known for, like, write funny. And this was not really funny. So it was hard for me not to be funny, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
One from one of the submissions that I liked, it's by Declarative Hill, and it says, "I don't understand chemistry," he said. "Ours," he clarified.
Laura Martinez is a senior editor for CNET en Español. Michael Skolnick is editor-in-chief of GlobalGrind.com. That's a news and entertainment site founded by Russell Simmons. They both joined us from our bureau in New York. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we still want to hear from you. Tweet us your poems. They have to be 140 characters or less. And then use the hashtag TMMPoetry. Next, it's time for the regular feature we call In Your Ear. That's where we invite some of our guests to tell us about the top songs on their playlists. We caught up with Muslim pop star Yuna earlier this year, and she told us about some of her favorite tunes.
Hey, I'm Yuna, and what's playing right now in my ears? Drake, In Time.
You a flower child, beautiful child, I'm in your zone. Looking like you came from the 70s on your own. My mother is 66, and a favorite line that hit me with is, "Who the f*** wants to be 70 and alone?"
I love the song because it features Jhené Aoki. My favorite line in this song is, "I love me enough for the both of us."
I love me enough for the both of us. That's why you trust me. I know you've been through more than most of us.
So what are you? Another song that I'm listening to is Paper Doll by John Mayer, and the reason why I love this song is because it kind of like a reminiscent of the earlier version of John Mayer that I really love.
Paper doll, come try it on. Step out of that black chiffon. Here's a dress of gold and blue. Sure was fun being good to you. My friends and I, we've cracked the code. We count our dollars on the train to the party, and everyone who knows us knows that we're fine with this. We didn't come for money.
And another another song that I'm listening to right now is Royals by Lorde. She's amazing. I feel like, you know, she's about to change the music industry, and I'm really proud of her. So yeah, Royals. Everybody's like crystal, Maybach, diamonds on your timepiece, jet planes, islands, tigers on a gold leash. We don't care. We aren't caught up in your love affair, and we'll never be royal. That was singer Yuna telling us what's playing in her ear. To hear our previous conversation with her, head over to npr.org, click on the Programs tab, and go to Tell Me More. You can call me Queen Bee, and baby, I'll rule. Let me live that fantasy. Just ahead, plenty of parents worry about their teens sexting.
It's one thing to say I'm sending my boyfriend over the internet pictures of me in a topless, but what happens if that boyfriend then turns around and sends it to five of his buddies who send it to five of their buddies? The girl herself loses any control over where that picture goes.
But now some parents and researchers say maybe it's not such a bad thing after all. We'll ask some moms and dads where they draw the line. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Celeste Headlee.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, helping people build measurably better lives, on the web at hewlett.org. From Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, driven by the power of knowledge to solve today's most challenging problems at pewtrusts.org. And from Joyce V. Hale, in the interest of engaging an informed and civil electorate. This is NPR.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, Roseanne Sadoya survived the marathon bombing but then had to endure a year of surgeries.
You know, I have friends that laugh and say, after all I've been through, I shouldn't worry so much about it, but the whole situation is a little unnerving.
We'll see how a survivor moves on next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Weekdays starting at noon on AM 580.
Hey, did you hear Pat talk last week?
I have ants in my car.
Ants?
Mm-hmm.
You need to have a picnic just outside your car.
And I would put up posters and stuff in advance.
You can't fake
like
them out.
Thursday, pick.
Rain or shine.
Every problem may not have a solution.
But it's always worth a couple of laughs. Join us this week for Car Talk.
Saturday morning at 9 and Sunday morning at 11 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store and Cafe. Strawberry Fields offers a wide selection of natural vitamins and body care products for all ages, and healthy back-to-school lunch and snack options. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
I'm Celeste Headlee, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Michelle Martin is away. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms and dads in your corner. Each week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And if you've seen your teenager with their head buried in a phone lately, you may have stopped to wonder, from time to time, what exactly your kid was doing. Maybe texting about homework, you hope. Maybe it's about the next school party or dance. Most parents really hope it's not explicit photos or messages. It might surprise you to learn, though, that some parents and researchers are kind of coming around on the idea of sexting. They see it as a normal part of a teenager's sexual development. Here to talk more about this is Ray Junco. He's a fellow at the Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, where he researches social media, also a dad of two. And Fernando Espuelas is host of his own program on Univision America and dad of two. Stephanie Silverman is the publisher of Your Teen magazine. She's also a mother of three, including two teenagers. And Leslie Morgan Steiner, author, mom of three, and one of our regular parenting contributors. Welcome all.
Thank you.
A pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Ray, let me begin with you, because you've been writing about this, and you are one of the people who kind of think this might be a normal expression of teenage sexuality. But I want to be clear, though, when you say that, you're talking about people over the age of 18, right?
Well, I am talking about over the age of 18, but I'm also talking about teenagers as well. I think that's one of the issues we have in our society, that we're so reticent to acknowledge the sexual development of our teenagers, of our young people.
Although I think that when a parent finds, especially a very graphic text that one of their kids may have sent, that raises some eyebrows. It causes concern.
Sure. What kind of concerns are you talking about?
Well, I mean, I think that most parents are worried, depending on the text, and we're going to be clear that this is radio, we're not going to explain. But some of them are quite graphic in terms of sexual content. And oftentimes, parents worry that that means that the kid is perhaps becoming too mature too fast, or getting sexually active in a way that is not healthy. How do you advise parents to deal with perhaps a very shocking text or picture?
Okay, well, what you said certainly is not the case, because the proportion of American adolescents who are sexually active has actually decreased over the last few decades. There's an increased use in contraceptives by adolescents over the last few decades, and adolescent pregnancies have also declined over the past two decades. So in terms of sexual behavior and things that we, kind of worry about if they're being sexually active, contraceptive use in pregnancy, that really is not as much of a concern. Also, research shows that sexting has no relationship to engaging in riskier sexual behavior like unprotected sex. So I think then the concern becomes just one issue, which is what we know, the one thing we know that sexting is related to, and that is engaging in sexual activity. And so to me, instead of it being a major concern for parents, it's a way that parents can actually begin a conversation with their teens about sexuality.
Leslie, I want to know what the difference is, for you at least, and with your kids, between a text, just words, and either photos or videos. Is there a difference?
Yes. The issue for me is that sending photos of naked body parts, whether they're yours or somebody else's, via your cell phone, for all of my kids, because they're all under age 18, is illegal. And in, state by state regulations vary, but it could be considered child pornography. And then if they sell it to somebody else, which has happened at schools in our area, they've charged to look at this naked picture, then you get into really murky territory. So I've been really clear with my kids that they cannot ever send pictures like that of themselves or anybody else. They can't pass it along. And also, the issue for me, too, is not so much that this is an indication that they're becoming sexually interested and active. I'm fine with that. I just don't want them to do anything that's illegal, or I don't want them to harass other kids. Like, what I worry a lot about is the person on the receiving end of this welcoming it? If it's mutual and consensual, then I'm comfortable with it. But I worry that one of my kids might receive something that they didn't want to receive, or they might send something that made another child feel really uncomfortable. And that's where I get really worried about my kids and other kids.
Fernando, let me go to you, because you have two sons.
Right.
The eldest is 14. Oftentimes, a lot of this talk about, you know, dealing with sexting focuses on girls, especially in terms of taking photos or videos. But in fact, research shows that boys are much more likely to share those photos with their friends than others. What do you tell your sons about this kind of thing?
Well, I think like Leslie, we've explained the legality issues and tried to take it away from any kind of moralistic message about what you should do or not do, and rather just put it in the most frightening way possible that you will end up in the pokey if this happens. And but we also have taken a very proactive approach to explaining to him the consequences of exactly, as Leslie was saying, the what happens when someone receives something they don't want, or including yourself. And but we've also given him freedom. We realized we could not be spies. And so his phone has a lock on it, which he put on. We stopped. He's in school. We stopped going through his email. And in fact, he got off Facebook on his own because we think he was being harassed by a pair of girls, actually.
That's why my son got off Facebook.
Yeah.
He had enough of those girls.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talk all the time. I had the most awkward conversation I've ever had in the world because he just had, about 6 months ago, his first girlfriend. I didn't catch them. I happened to see them making out in the living room, which, of course, was the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. And afterwards, my wife gave me on a post-it note 5 things I had to say to him about, it, you know, you're too young, I will buy you condoms, however. And we just looked at each other completely scared out of our minds. And then he said, is that it? I said, yeah, that's it. Any questions? No. Okay. And so I left. And so,
Shortest conversation ever.
Ever. But very clear. I had the points from
right.
The
you
mom.
Had to post it. That's always... Well, Stephanie, you published your teen magazine. What kind of concerns... Maybe you are a better person to answer Ray's question in what are the concerns that parents have about sexting?
Well, and I think that Leslie said it. You know, it is illegal under the age of 18. So you've got that to contend with. And I think a softer consequence, for lack of a better word, is just even reputation. And what does that mean? And I think, you know, these conversations have to be had at an earlier time with these kids. Hopefully you've had a conversation if you do discover that photo on your kid's phone, you know, whether they've sent it or received it, that you've already been having those conversations. And I think it's not too early to have those conversations in the preteen years. Even when they're 8, 9, 10, you're starting to talk about their body and body changes. And so this is all just gearing up, I guess, eventually to a post-it filled with 5 things you have to say to them. But that's where you're leading toward. And it's not so much, these kids can make mistakes, there's no question, and we all made mistakes. The problem is that we were able to make mistakes privately.
Yeah.
And they can make the mistakes much more publicly.
There's the rub. And if you're just joining us, our parenting panel is talking about sexting. You just heard Stephanie Silverman of Your Teen Magazine, also joined by writer Leslie Morgan Steiner, radio host Fernando Espuelas, and social media expert Ray Junco. Ray, let's talk about these privacy concerns. Mm-hmm. If we accept that sexting is now a kind of a normal part of teenage and then on to young adult sexual development, where does the law kind of enter into that?
Okay, well, I think we're talking about 2 issues. We're talking about legal and we're talking about social. And the law is, it's not as dreadful as we've been discussing so far. There certainly sexting could fall under child pornography laws. There are very rare instances when that has happened, and there's quite a bit of backlash against prosecutors who try to prosecute minors under child pornography laws for sexting. 17 states actually have created legislation that either decriminalizes sexting or makes it a misdemeanor. So that's something to keep in mind, that it's, you know, your kids are probably not going to go to jail I just, you know,
you hear that, Fernando? They're not going to the pokey.
They're not going to jail. And Fernando, I'm happy to review any post-it notes if you need some help.
There's a business opportunity here. Many people might want your wife's post-it note.
Oh, it was good.
Seriously. Yeah. You could see that at the bookstore, you know.
Okay, so notes. Leslie, you're pretty pragmatic about it. I mean, you all seem to be fairly pragmatic. What happens? What's your advice to a parent who looks at their kid's phone and sees a graphic sext, either from or to their kid?
Well, I think, you know, take a deep breath and think through the issues before you go running after the kid. But definitely don't bury your head in the sand. It's actually a great opportunity to talk to your child. And I would say don't apologize for being a spy. I am my kid's spy. I look through their stuff. I look through their Facebook posts. It's part of my responsibilities as a parent. And talk to them openly about it and tell them why you're concerned. And again, it's as I said earlier, my biggest concern is that my kids, you know, I want them to be able to stand up for themselves if they're getting sexually oriented messages that they don't want. And I do not want them inflicting that on anybody else. But I also want them to feel really good about their sexuality. And I think that that's another important part of parenting.
So this actually happened to you, Stephanie, as I understand, this kind of situation in which you found something on your kid's phone. What happened?
Yeah, so, and it goes back, if he was in seventh or eighth, I think he was in seventh grade at the time, and a young lady had lifted her shirt, took a picture, sent it to a boy who had asked her to send it. That boy then passed it on to a bunch of other boys, my son being one of them. And it really, as prepared as I am in the world to deal with this from a business perspective, I couldn't believe it was actually happening in my own home. And I saw it. I happened to be going through his phones, checking it periodically, as Leslie was talking about, and it teed up the conversation. And, you know, it was the longest day waiting for him. I think for some reason his phone was at home, and I was waiting for him to get home, and I thought, oh, my God. It was really, you know, prepping for the conversation. And the conversation was, hey, I saw this on your phone. At first he was very cavalier, no big deal. Took him about 15 minutes, sat back down with me, and he said, oh, I feel really badly. And we started talking about it in the context of, you know, this young lady, she sent it to someone. It was, first of all, it wasn't even meant for you to receive. So there's that piece, right? And then just what the implications are that this is on your phone and that this is illegal. And, you know, I think where it really hit home for him was when I started putting it in the context of, what if this had been your cousin, whom he's very close to, a young lady who's his age? What if this had been your friend so-and-so? What if this had been your sister?
So for
that changed, all of a sudden he had that aha, yeah, wait a minute.
And I want to take that to you, Fernando, because you don't spy on your kid's phone or other social media, I guess. And yet your kid left Facebook because you think he may have been getting harassed. Do you not worry that about, well, you know, what he may be going through?
First of all, I should clarify that we stopped our spying recently.
Oh, I see.
Okay. so as not to, just to be totally transparent. But he's a very mature guy, and but he's 14, so, it, you know, by definition, his brain is half monkey, half man. And so we try to deal with that reality. But at the same time, he's one of these, I guess, typical boys. We're told by all our sisters-in-laws who have boys, he doesn't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
And the more we try to force a conversation out, the quieter he becomes. So there, you know, I try to take moments when we're driving somewhere and just casually bring up, you know, who he's dating or what's going to happen, and, you know, and do you have any questions? Should I be helping you? I mean, we take a proactive role in trying to understand what's going on. For example, my wife pointed out the last 2 weeks he's been, you know, basically whistling to work and happy as can be. And finally, my wife told me last night, it must be a girl. You know, there's a girl now involved and it's all good, you know. But we've seen the other side of that when things go bad with a girl and he's down and moody and depressed.
So Ray, let me bring this back to you, because I know that your theory is that sexting is relatively normal. And I assume that's because this is, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you assuming that sexting are just the things that used to be shared between friends verbally and is now shared between people over a cell phone or Twitter?
Yeah, that's right. And there's also no data to show that, you know, it's anything different than previous communications about sexuality.
So, I mean, I doubt that a lot of parents sat down and had conversations with their kids about what they talk about with their friends, right? So how does that change? How does that conversation then change, do you think, if this is just a digital version of what we all used to do?
Right. Well, I think that's, I mean, you've answered the question. I think it's a great in to talking with your kids about sexuality. I like that what Fernando said, that he keeps trying to talk with his sons about, you know, who they're dating and things like that. And, you know, sometimes it's like pulling teeth and eventually they will talk to us about it. And I think it's also, you know, in addition to that, I think it's also important to, you know, kind of open up with them too and kind of, you know, share, because often as parents, we don't tend to talk to our kids about, you know, our relationship with the other parent. And so that, you know, that might be something to include as well as modeling to how to talk about relationships.
So where's the drawing line for you, Ray? At what point would you get concerned?
I think the big concern here is about images being shared. And on the one hand, research shows that doesn't happen with great frequency. So only 2% of sexters, of adolescent sexters, have had their photo shared with someone they didn't want to see it. That being said, that's still 2%.
Yeah.
And our society has some interesting double standards about sexuality, where it's everywhere. We sexualize everything, including adolescents in movies and advertising. But then when it comes to our kids having some kind of sexual identity, then we freak out about it. And I think that needs to stop.
That's Ray Junco, fellow at Harvard University's Berkman Center for Internet and Society, also father of two. He joined us from member station WBAA in West Lafayette, Indiana. I was also joined by Leslie Morgan Steiner, author, mom of three, one of our regular parenting contributors. Fernando Espuelas, host of his own program on Univision America, dad of two. They both joined me here in our Washington studios. And Stephanie Silverman is the publisher of Your Teen magazine, and she was on the line from Cleveland. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's our program for today. I'm Celeste Headlee. You've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News, and we'll talk more tomorrow.